Good morning. I found out last week I've got to really be careful what I say up here, because some of you guys, yeah, well, anyway, having said that, this is what showed up. Can we get a little close up there? I want you to, can you get closer than that? I want you to see the face. For those of you who were here last week, I said, you know, it's just people's idea of what angels, you know, what angels look like. And so, you know, I go into the bathrooms of people from our church, and they've got like little angels that are have a look on their face like, quit that. Like, it's embarrassing, okay? So anyway, that's what I get for saying that. I know where that's going. Come to my house, you're going to be embarrassed. Have you gotten all romanced out yet? Guys? Has she romanced you enough? She can never romance you enough, right? Us guys, we crave it. We got to have it, romance, more and more and more. You know, we love late night talks, long, into the wee hours. We love that. It's just who we are. Sorry, God made us that way. But since we know that not everybody is wired that way, it's okay from our standpoint, the guys, if we just take some time off, maybe till next Valentine's Day, give everybody a break. Now, we're sitting here, and it's the 15th of February. Sermon's got nothing to do with Valentine's Day, okay? Just get that out of your brain, nothing to do with Valentine's Day. What I want you to do is I want you to take a little trip with me, but I'm not going to pay for it, so you're going to have to do it right here. What I'd like you to do is just travel with me forward in your life. Now, it may help you to just close your eyes right where you are, so you can kind of visualize this journey. So I know it's dangerous for a pastor to tell people to close their eyes at the beginning of the message. That usually happens someplace in the middle or toward the end. But just close your eyes. I want you to take a little journey with me, okay? What I want you to do is I want you to journey forward in time to the last day of your earthly existence. This is the last day of your life. Now, I don't know if you'll visualize yourself significantly older, different locale, different place, but just kind of, you're on the last day of your life. Now, in that moment, are you in that moment? In that moment, who you are, your character, the person that you are, that can't change. It's done, okay? Not tomorrow I'm going to get up and do better. It's done. That your history of who you are is written. And then what you did with this precious life that you had, it's over. There's not like, well, tomorrow I'm going to go back and do what I never did before. It's over. So here we are. Your life is at the end. And as you look to tomorrow, the day after your earthly life ends, what do you envision? Nothingness? Do you envision that, like, it's over? You're gone? Sleeping without a dream? It's the end of your existence? Do you envision yourself in the presence of divinity? In the place of God? Enjoying bliss? Or maybe you picture yourself stepping into judgment or condemnation based on the way you lived your life. What is it? Okay, this is your last day. What's going on in your mind? What do you see from the past? What do you see into the future? Now, let me get you back from that, okay? Come on back in here, okay? Everybody back? Come on back. Because Daniel is there. The man we've been studying for really almost 11 weeks now. I guess this is the 11th week. The man we've been studying for 11 weeks, that's where he's at. He's well up into his 80s now. He's receiving his final revelation. The revelation is going to close with the angel telling Daniel that you're going to now rest. So he's at the end of his life. He doesn't have anything to change. There's nothing he can redo. He can't become something different. His life is over. And then he's been given a revelation of the future, what the future is going to look like, where he's headed, what his life is going to be like in the future. And in order for us to grasp the magnitude of the moment that Daniel is describing here, we've got to put ourselves in his shoes. Where are you headed? Who have you become? If today was the last day of your life and you had a half an hour to ponder it, like, what would you be thinking? Where would you see yourself? Now, in order to get us into the context, this revelation actually began in chapter 10, and Daniel experienced the presence of this angelic being that shows up to give him a foretaste of what's going to take place in the future. Now, keep in mind that from chapter 8 to chapter 12, all the prophecies have been concerning the nation of Israel. So all of the material that refers to all the nations around is simply setting the stage for what's taking place to the nation of Israel. In chapter 9, we saw it clearly laid out that God had a period of time for his people. And that period of time was 70 sevens. And that was divided up into sections. The first 69 sevens, or 483 years, took place from the time that Artaxerxes said rebuild the city until the very day, Palm Sunday, the week that the Messiah was going to be cut off. Then there's this last seven that is out there someplace in the future. It hadn't been fulfilled in history yet, so this last seven or seven-year period, most of us understand that in the Bible to be called the tribulation period. And that week is a week that God's going to work with Israel, that seven-year period, he's working. And so all of the data that we're going to be looking at, Daniel's going to hear that in relationship to the nation of Israel. Also, Daniel has been face-to-face with these angelic beings, and his experience with these angelic beings has left him in a heap. At one point, Daniel passes out, and then he's on his hands and knees on the ground, just being in the very presence of these incredible beings. He can't even stand it. So he says, I'm having trouble breathing. I can't speak. He's overwhelmed with the power and the magnitude and the glory of these angelic beings. Now, Daniel is writing in the 500s B.C., 535, 536. That's the time when he's writing this down. And the prophecy is going to talk about what happens in history from that point forward all the way to the time of the Maccabees in 163 BC. And then there's this seven-year period that's still out there in the future. So having said that, let's pick up in Daniel chapter 11, verse 2. And in this verse, he starts to hear the revelation from the angel of what's going to take place in his future. Now, I've divided the message up into two parts. The first part is prophecy that has already been fulfilled in history. And that's the majority of this passage. The second part is prophecy that's yet to be fulfilled, that hadn't come to pass yet. So, looking at the prophecy that's already been fulfilled, starting in verse 2, he says, now then, I tell you the truth, three more kings will appear in Persia. So, we got Cyrus, and then three more kings will appear in Persia. And then a fourth who will be far richer than all the others. When he has gained power by his wealth, he will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. Now, keep in mind, Daniel is living during the reign of Cyrus now. Three more kings, then one great king who's going to stir up Greece. Okay, let me show you who these people are on the slide. Let me put it up here for you. Persian Empire, the three kings are Cambyses, Smyrdis, and Darius I were three kings in succession right after Cyrus. And then the king, the rich king that's going to attack the Greeks is none other than Xerxes I. How many of you saw the movie The 300? A couple of you saw that movie? That's basically a dramatization of the battles that began to take place when Xerxes decided that he wanted the Greek Empire too, and he was the first Persian king that really went all out after the Greeks. So Daniel's seeing the future that's being prophesied to him, and everything that's being prophesied down to which number of kings, this great king, the richest one so far, what he does, he attacks the Greeks, and that starts the battle between the Greek Empire and the Persian Empire. Now, the rest of the kings of the Persian Empire are not mentioned because they're not important. What's important to the angelic prophecy is to let us know that there's going to be a retaliation which will start the Greek Empire. And so it's 476 that the Persians are fighting or marching against the Greeks. It's going to be over 100 years later, 334 BC, when Alexander the Great comes back and conquers the Persian Empire. Now, could Daniel possibly get that right too? Well, let's look at the next verse. Then a mighty king will appear who will rule with great power and do as he pleases. After he has appeared, his empire will be broken up and parched out toward the four winds of heaven. It will not go to his descendants, nor will it have the power he exercised, because his empire will be uprooted and given to others. Now, we've already discussed this great king. This is none other than Alexander the Great, the conqueror of the Persian Empire. I'll put the slide up here for you. The mighty king. He's not going to leave his empire to his descendants, as the text says. He's going to leave it to his four generals. It's going to be parceled up among his four generals. I don't know about you. This is phenomenal. Like, how in the world could this be true, accurate? How could it happen? Well, it gets even better. Notice the next verse. The king of the south, now that's one of the four, that's the Ptolemies in Egypt, will become strong, but one of his commanders will become even stronger than he and will rule his own kingdom with great power. After some years, they will become allies. The daughter, her name's Bernice, by the way, the daughter of the king of the south will go to the king of the north to make an alliance, but she will not retain power, and he and his power will not last. In those days, she will be handed over together with her royal escort and her father and the one who supports her. Guys, we're going to stop right there, and the reason why we're going to stop right there is because I could teach a whole history course on the history of the Hellenistic period of Greece from this passage that was written over 200 years before the Greek Empire made any kind of impact on the world. Now, you say, like, how do you know? Like, the king of the south, king of the north, their battles and all this kind of stuff. Well, again, like, I could spend a couple days with you guys walking you through what has already happened in history, but I just put it on our website so you could look it up yourself, okay? So if you go to the sermon page on the website, there's a thing in there that walks you through all of the people, down to the number of times the Roman army is involved, the tax collectors that were hired, the intrigue of how kings died, who fought what battles. There was actually six battles that were fought between the Seleucids, the Syrians, the kings of the north, and the Ptolemies, the kings of the south. And Daniel gets it right. Over 138 specific details of history outlined hundreds of years before they happened. So get on the website, check it out, which led some people around the 1900s to say, this could not have been done. Nobody could have predicted that. Daniel must be a fictitious character, and this must have been made up after the fact. And there's a whole school of people who believe that Daniel didn't actually write this, and they came up with several reasons why they couldn't. Now, here's the interesting thing about that. In the early 1900s, we had not discovered the Ebla tablets. We had not discovered the Mari tablets. We didn't have much of a knowledge of Ugaritic or cuneiform. We didn't have the Dead Sea Scrolls. There's a whole bunch of information that we didn't know back then. The information that we know today, when applied to literary and biblical scholarship, proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that Daniel and only Daniel could have written this, and it could only have been written during the later Babylonian and early Persian kingdom. In fact, Daniel used several loan words from the Persian language in his writing. And people in the 1900s said, see, it had to be written by somebody else because these words that Daniel used were made up. They don't exist in the Persian language. Until we actually found Persian inscriptions from the time of Nebuchadnezzar and Cyrus the king, and now we see those exact words were used then, and they weren't used in the second century when they purported to have fabricated this book. You say, well, man, I'd love to study that. Great. I put some stuff on the website, some articles that you can go to. You can look it up. There's two history articles that go through the manuscript evidence. There's one linguistic article that talks about the specific character of the language of Daniel and why it could only be written in this time period. Folks, amazing. Like, I didn't embrace Christianity because my Sunday school teacher said, Jesus loves me, this I know. I didn't embrace Christianity because we walked around the chairs in the basement of the building that we had our Sunday school class in, and when we kicked the chairs and they fell down, we thought, oh, yeah, I guess the walls of Jericho could fall down. I became a Christian because we found the walls of Jericho. We know where they are. And we know what direction that they fell when they crumbled. And there's incontrovertible evidence for the historicity and reliability of the Bible. So even though there are things about Christianity that I don't understand, and some things that we're going to look at later in this passage that I don't particularly like, it doesn't make any difference because if it's true, it's true. Find me somebody that can write history in advance with this kind of detail and specificity, and I am listening. I'm listening, okay? You can study the history part today. We're going to jump to the stuff that hasn't been fulfilled yet, okay? So get on the website, look that up. You take a class in the ancient Near East. By the way, the Hellenistic period, I didn't like that period. Too many kings. It was really confusing. You had to have a prophet like Daniel to be able to explain it all to you because it was so detailed. Anyway, let's jump ahead a little bit. All of that is discussed until you get to verse 36, all these different wars and battles and people. And in verse 36, it sounds like the tone changes. The tone of the king, the tone of the individual changes. Some people assume that this is still a discussion of one of the kings, Antiochus Epiphanes, that lived during that day. But everything now changes, and we went from having very specific detail fulfilled to having stuff that doesn't make any sense, which implies the possibility that what takes place here is we begin to jump from Antiochus Epiphanes all the way to a future ruler. In fact, the passage begins to explain that this appears to be a description of that 70th seven, that last seven-year period that we in the New Testament call the tribulation period. And the person being described here is none other than the Antichrist. Look at the description. In verse 36, it says, "The king will do as he pleases. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god and will say unheard of things against the God of gods. He will be successful until the time of wrath is completed. For what has been determined must take place. He will show no regard for the gods of his fathers or for the one desired by women, nor will he regard any god, but will exalt himself above them all." Now that is not a description of the Seleucid king, Antiochus Epiphanes, because he worshipped his ancestral gods. He set up a statue to Zeus right in the temple of Jerusalem. So this is talking about somebody who's completely anti-God. Okay, completely anti-God. Second thing is, it's very clear that all of this comes about at the very end of time. In fact, in verse 2 of chapter 12, we see that it talks about the resurrection of the dead. Multiples who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. So it appears that this is the last person who rules the kingdom of this world, and he is none other than the Antichrist. Let me give you a couple passages of Scripture. I'm going to give you a bunch of passages of Scripture. I'll put them up there so you can see them, so you don't have to look them down, up right now. You might want to write them down. You can look them up later. The first one is in Daniel chapter 9. Speaking of this person in Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, it says, he will confirm a covenant with many for 1/7. In the middle of the 7, he will put an end to the sacrifice and offering. And on the wing of the temple, he will set an abomination that causes desolation until the end that is decreed is poured out on him. So, some point in the future, the Antichrist is going to make a covenant with everybody to bring about peace. Halfway through that, at 3.5 years, he's going to break the covenant. And at that point in time, there's going to be all kinds of pain and suffering until the end comes, which is the end of human history as we know it, at the end of that seven-year period. In the New Testament, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, Paul talking about this, and he's answering the question, what about the end of time? People are saying we're in the last days, and here's what Paul says. He says, don't let anyone deceive you in any way, for that day will not come until the rebellion occurs and the man of lawlessness, that's his term for the Antichrist, the man of lawlessness is revealed, the man doomed to destruction. He will oppose and exalt himself over everything that is called God or is worshipped, so that he sets himself up where? In God's temple, that's the 3.5 years, in God's temple, proclaiming himself to be God. So there's someone coming in the future, this Antichrist. He's going to set himself up to be God, boasting over everything. And then one more passage of Scripture, Revelation chapter 3, verse 5 and 6, the beast, describing the same person, the beast was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemy and to exercise his authority for 42 months. That's 3.5 years. He opens his mouth to blaspheme God and to slander his name and his dwelling place and those who live in heaven. So I think the person that's being described here, this vile person, is the Antichrist. Then he goes on to talk about the last great war. In verse 40, it says, at the time of the end, the king of the south will engage him in battle, and the king of the north will storm out against him with chariots and cavalry and a great fleet of ships. So the king of the north is the Antichrist. He's the ruler of that fourth kingdom that we talked about. He's the little horn that we talked about. He's going to come out, battle the king of the south. He will invade many countries, will sweep through them like a flood. He will also invade the beautiful land. That's a description of Palestine or the Jewish nation. Many countries will fall, but Edom, Moab, and the leaders of Ammon will be delivered from his hand. That's the area of Jordan today. He will extend his power over many countries. Egypt will not escape. He will gain control of the treasures of gold and silver, all the riches of Egypt with the Libyans and the Nubians in submission. But reports from the east and the north will alarm him. He will set out in a great rage to destroy and annihilate many. There's a prophecy of Gog and Magog coming from the north in Ezekiel, and in the book of Revelation, a great army from the east making its way over. He hears reports of these coming, so he's going out to fight them and annihilate many. He will pitch his royal tent between the seas at the beautiful holy mountain. In other words, he will establish his headquarters in Jerusalem, which explains the prophecy of the final battle being fought in the Holy Land. And it says, yet he will come to his end, and no one will help him. Now, that's looking at it from his point of view. In chapter 12, verse 1, we read, at that time, Michael, the great prince who protects your people. Remember last week we talked about Michael, the archangel, who's responsible to take care of the nation of Israel. In chapter 12 of Revelation, there's a great war in heaven between he and the dragon that takes place there, the Antichrist and Satan. It says, he will arise, there will be a time of distress as has not happened from the beginning of nations until then. That phrase, the beginning of nations, literally refers to the beginning of civilization. From the first organized group of humans that came together to begin to form civilization and all the battles that had ever been fought and all the conflicts that have ever been waged in the history of the world, this time, when the wars are taking place between the Antichrist, the army from the north, the army from the east, and ultimately in chapter 19, we're going to see Jesus Christ enters the battle of Armageddon. That period of time is going to be the worst that's ever happened in the history of humanity. It goes on to say, be a time of distress such as not happened from the beginning of nations until then. But at that time, your people Everyone whose name is found written in the book will be delivered. Multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens, and those who lead many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. But you, Daniel, close up and seal the words of the scroll until the time of the end. Many will go here and there to increase in knowledge. Okay? So, trying to kind of pull this together, what do we see taking place here? We see that there's this incredible time, this conflict, this battle that takes place at the time when it appears that the nation of Israel is going to be destroyed. There's this promise that those whose names are written in the book of life, they're going to be spared. They're going to be saved. Now, in the ancient world, every city would have its roster of citizens. That was a common thing. It was called their book of the city. And so they could differentiate between those families who lived there, kind of like our voter registration, those families who lived there, and those people who were just passing through. And to have your name on the roster or in the book of life meant that you had citizenship. And the angel is using this terminology to say that there are people today who've got their name written in the book of the city of the New Jerusalem. And if your name is in the book, then you can have confidence that you're going to enter into the New Jerusalem. Your name is recorded. You're one of its citizens. I don't know about you, but I kind of have this phobia that whenever I'm traveling, if I've made hotel arrangements or have had somebody make them for me in advance, then I'm going to get to the hotel and they're not going to have my reservations. Or, you know, if I'm registered for a conference, I'm going to show up and I'm going to get there and they hadn't really registered me and they don't have a name tag for me and I'm not welcome. And I don't know, it's just me. It's kind of weird. I understand. I'm a little weird person, but that's a paranoia I have. And a couple weeks ago when we had a threat of inclement weather here in Austin, they actually had freezing rain and ice in Dallas, and I happened to be there for a conference. So I'm in this conference while about an inch and a half of freezing rain is coming down over everything, and when I come out, there my little Honda Civic is just coated with ice. Well, I got the door open, got inside, started it up, but I didn't have an ice scraper. So I opened the glove compartment, and I reached in the glove compartment, and there among the CD cases was a Clay Aiken CD. Now, I won't give any names away, but there is someone in my house that loves American Idol, has loved it since the Clay days. And she purchased one of those original CDs, and it wasn't hard for me to determine that that would be a good ice scraper. So, you know, I used Clay Aiken to get the ice off my windows. I don't think he'll ever play again in our automobile. And but you know, it was an emergency. It was dangerous. I needed to do that. So I get in my car, and it takes me about 45 minutes driving about 20 miles an hour on these icy roads to get to the hotel. And I pull in the parking lot of the hotel, and I'm thinking to myself, I didn't make these reservations. The conference made them for me. I sure hope my name is on the register, because if I have to go someplace else, it's not going to be pretty. Well, fortunately, my name was there. But my question to you is, who put your name on the register of the New Jerusalem? Is your name in that book? And what confidence do you have that whoever's making your arrangements is reliable? What confidence do you have that the person who's making sure that your name is recorded has the ability to actually get it written in there? You know, a lot of us are trusting in our wits. A lot of us are just rolling the dice. Like when we get there, we'll be able to make an impassioned plea. Please, 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 I didn't really know. Or, you know, some of us are just hoping there is no book, that we're writing our own book. You better make sure that the person who's making your arrangements for your final destination has secured it with the Father. You better be looking to Jesus Christ. Second thing that we see in this section on the kingdom here is that there is a resurrection of the body for all people. There is a resurrection of the body for all people. Look at verse 2. It says in verse 2, multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. Now, this idea that there's a bodily resurrection, that's not a New Testament concept. That's firmly taught throughout the Old Testament. The Jewish people believed that, and right here it's just as clear as can be. There's coming a time at some point in the future, this is at the end of time, when God is going to call our human bodies. And according to Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, if you missed that passage when I taught on it last fall, you can get online and listen to it, 1 Corinthians 15. God's going to call our bodies to be reconstituted and then changed into a better, a permanent, an eternal body. We will be reunited with our spirit, and we will live forever. That's a New Testament concept, or an Old Testament and a New Testament concept. Well, in fact, listen to the words of Jesus. Jesus writing in John chapter 5, or Jesus talking in John chapter 5 says this. This is Jesus talking. He says, "Do not be amazed at this, for a time is coming when all who are in their graves will hear his voice and come out. Those who have done the good will rise to live. Those who have done the evil will rise to be condemned." There's coming a time when every single person, is going to be resurrected into a new body. In fact, this passage says it's going to be an eternal existence. It says, multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life and some to everlasting contempt. So everlasting, either on the life side or on the contempt and shame side, you're gonna live forever in some state. Now, let's talk about the two states. The first one that he talks about is this everlasting life concept. Jesus referred to that in John 3:16, a verse that we all know. Let me put it up here for you. It says, "For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him," what will happen? "They will not perish, but they will have eternal life." That's life in the presence of God, enjoying the blessing of God. Now, this passage says, though, the second option is that some will be raised to shame and everlasting contempt. Shame and everlasting contempt. Isaiah 66:4, talking about this final battle of Armageddon, Isaiah uses the same term. Look at what it says. I put it up there for you. "And they will go out and look upon the dead bodies, those who rebelled against me. Their worm will not die, nor will their fire be quenched." In other words, they're going to be resurrected or they're going to be back to life, but they will be loathsome to all mankind. That word loathsome is the same word as contempt. Now, here's the image. As you look over a battlefield and you see the twisted carnage of dead people, you can't help but turn away. Not just because of the goriness of the scene, but also because of the absolute waste. Rather than seeing a young 19-year-old man living and enjoying his life as God created him to, promoting justice and righteousness, being someone who loves people and who cares for people, maybe raises a family, maybe builds a company, maybe plants a vineyard, maybe does something to cure humanity with healing hands of a medical professional. Rather than that, you see this awful, horrible sight, this potential of humanity wasted. And what Daniel's saying here is there's going to be some that are raised to live life in the presence of God with all of the glory and potential and goodness that God created when he breathed life into Adam and he said, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, rule over it, be my representative on the planet, bring in shalom to this planet. That's a good life. That's what you were created for. That's what you're supposed to experience. Joy, love, peace, helping your fellow man, being in the presence of God, worshiping him. There's going to be some that are raised to life. But there are going to be some that are raised not to experience the presence of God, to be in an existence that is not filled with justice and righteousness and love and joy and productivity. That's called eternal punishment. The New Testament word is hell. That is an overwhelming concept. Of all the things that I struggle with, knowing that billions of people on this planet are going to find their fate not in life for all of eternity, but in contempt and shame for all eternity, that is an overwhelming thing to me. And if there wasn't overwhelming evidence for the gospel and the reality of Jesus that I experience on a day-to-day basis, both in my mind and in my experience, it would be easy to turn away from Christianity because that is such a hard thing to face. But rather than ignoring truth, which so many of our culture are prone to do, I don't like it, let me just ignore it. The Bible's not calling us to ignore it. God doesn't call us to ignore it any more than he calls a doctor to say, when I see all the terminal patients, I just want to turn away. I'm going to go do something else. I'm going to ignore that. No, the doctor runs into that environment and does what he can. We are called to do the same thing, to go into our world and do what we can to help people connect with Jesus Christ. That's what we're called on to do. And that's why in the next verse, verse 4, we get this incredible statement. Or verse 3, he says, those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens, and those who lead many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. What's the honor in the kingdom? Those who are wise, those who understand this, those who embrace Jesus, they're going to shine, but you know who's going to shine even brighter? Those who were wise and were reaching out to bring other people to righteousness. Those are the people that are really going to shine in God's economy. I don't know about you guys, but it's almost overwhelming. I mean, it breaks my heart. And sometimes when I think about God, and he looks at the average American churched person and sees how little concern we have to share the good news of the gospel with our friends, I've got to be thinking, he's wondering at times, like, why did I pick those people? Why did I pick them? How can for 1 minute I be satisfied with the hope of heaven and not overwhelmed with the need to tell my friends, my coworkers, my fellow men, my fellow women, children in this community, that Jesus Christ has the answer. He's paid for your sin. You can have eternal life in him. How can that not motivate me? If you're smug today with the blessing of heaven and insensitive to those who don't know Jesus, do we even get it? Do we get it? There's a real, real world conflict taking place here. We're called on to engage. Let's wrap up Daniel. A couple more thoughts here. He says, but you, close up the words, seal up the scroll until the end of time. That was sealing up the scroll essentially was saying, you know, when you put the scroll, the seal on it, this is done. This is it. This is what's going to happen. Seal up the scroll to the end of time. Many will go here and there and increase in knowledge. That's not information. Okay, some people think that's a prophecy of the internet. What that means is that people are going to learn more about this than Daniel knew. I mean, think about Daniel. There was no knowledge of Alexander the Great. He had no knowledge that all of these things were going to be taking place. We know so much more today about the end times and what's going to happen. We're increasing in our knowledge of what's taking place here. He goes on to say, then I, Daniel, looked, and there before me stood two others, one on this bank of the river and one on the opposite bank. I said to the man who was clothed in linen, who was above the waters of the river, how long will it be before these astonishing things are fulfilled? And the man clothed in linen, who was above the waters of the river, lifted his right hand and his left hand toward heaven. And I heard him swear by him who lives forever, saying, it will be for a time, times, and half a time. This period is 3.5 years. When the power of the holy people has been finally broken. It's what happens at the abomination of desolation in the middle of the tribulation period. All these things will be completed. I heard, but I did not understand. So I asked him, my Lord, what will the outcome of all this be? And he replied, go your way, Daniel, because the words are closed up and sealed until the end of time. Many will be purified, made spotless and refined, but the wicked will continue to be wicked. None of the wicked will understand, but those who are wise will understand. From the time that the daily sacrifice is abolished and the abomination that causes desolation is set up, there will be 1,290 days. That's 3.5 years plus 30 days. Probably the time it takes to judge the nation after the Battle of Eden. Blessed waits for, reaches the end of 5 days. That's 40 later. Probably the coronation of the establishment. We're not sure. First, he says, that way, you will reference to his then at the evil rise, you're alive in that Daniel. Daniel never owned a plot of land in this world. He didn't have a starter home. He didn't have a home with 4 bedrooms to make sure all the kiddos had the bedroom. He didn't have a retirement home with a condo down on the lake. He didn't have any of that. Daniel never got married. He never experienced romance. He never had children. Daniel was essentially a slave in the house of the masters who killed his family, wiped out his people. And as he worked his way up through God's blessing to positions of power, he was always still living in a foreign land at the whim of the one who was over him. Daniel never experienced the American dream. What we spend most of our time thinking about and working for, Daniel never got in this lifetime. And yet this passage says, Daniel, when your life is over and the end comes, I've got an allotted inheritance picked out for you. I got a place in the kingdom that will be your place, and it will be eternal. Now, Daniel fits the category not only of the wise, but of those who bring people to righteousness. For centuries, people have been reading the book of Daniel. And by reading the book of Daniel and getting a picture of the end, they've fallen on their face before God and they've embraced God. In fact, let me take you down a path that's even more bizarre. I personally believe that the book of Daniel is going to be the single greatest factor in the nation of Israel coming back and accepting Jesus as the Messiah, which is prophesied during the to happen during the tribulation period. I believe that people will be reading the book of Daniel. Now, prophecy goes like this. Let me show it to you. Zechariah chapter 12, talking about the end, the nation of Israel, what's going to happen. Verse 10, put it up here for you. I will pour out on the house of David, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, a spirit of grace and supplication. They will look on me. This is something that happens in the future. They will look on me, the one they have pierced. Who did they pierce? Crucify him, crucify him. He's not our Messiah. They will look on me, the one whom they have pierced, and they will mourn for him as one mourns for an only child, and grieve bitterly for him as one grieves for a firstborn son. The whole Passover son, the son that was killed as a sacrifice for the nation, the only begotten son of God, the nation will look back and say, we missed Jesus. And the passage goes on to say, on that day, weeping in Jerusalem will be great, like the weeping of Hadad-Ramon in the plain of Megiddo. The plain of Megiddo is where the Battle of Armageddon takes place. You see what they're going to do? is they're going to read the book of Daniel and they're going to say, whoa, how did we miss Jesus as our Messiah? And they'll go back to chapter 9 and they'll add up the days from the time that Artaxerxes issued the decree to rebuild the city to the time that Jesus was cut off, exactly to the day. And they'll say, what were we thinking? Jesus was our Messiah. And they will fall on their face and turn to him. And Daniel will be responsible through his prophetic revelation for seeing the nation of Israel come back to faith. He's going to have an inheritance in the life to come. How about you? Two questions. Are you wise? Have you placed your faith in the one who has the ability to put your name in the book of life on the citizens' roster of the New Jerusalem? Have you put your trust in Jesus? Number two, are you giving your life to ensure that the people in your sphere of influence hear the good news from you so that they can avoid the shame and contempt of eternity and embrace the glory of everlasting life? Let's bow our heads together. Father in heaven, as powerful and as high